I still can't tell if this microphone is broken. It's like weirdly loud now. Alright, guys. You are listening to the Fuck a Diet Radio. My name is Caroline Dooner. I am the creator of the Fuck a Diet, and I'm drinking kombucha, which means that I feel like a lot of air is trapped inside. Exactly. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I haven't figured this out. I haven't figured out how to not get in my own way. Okay. So, I am continuing the project where I read my old blog posts from the beginning of my very own Fuck a Diet out loud on this podcast. And there are a couple reasons for that. First of all, I was discovering so much as I went and did this and experimented on myself and kind of had these big spiritual epiphanies and did these kind of like physical appetite experiments on myself, I suppose. But also, so basically, it's kind of like a nice intro. It's a nice way to get into all of the things that have gone into what the Fuck a Diet is and has become. And that's actually the only reason that I'm doing it. I don't even know what I thought the other reason was, but that's the reason. Okay, so we have made it up to June 24th, 2012, and this post is called In Defense of Midnight Snacks, and I have no idea if it's good because sometimes I write things that aren't helpful. So let's see. Let's see what this is. This is what I wrote. For as long as I can remember, I've been unable to sleep if I'm hungry. This is true still. I must eat before bed or I won't fall asleep. Something substantial, too. In fact, the nights I've tried to sleep with a hunger pang because I convinced myself I was tired enough, I just ended up lying there until I got out of bed and ate some damn food. So, out of necessity, I've been ignoring that rule that you hear a lot, the don't eat 3 hours before bed or whatever variation you may hear, because it was truly, genuinely impossible for me to follow. But recently, as I've been reading more about adrenal fatigue, hypothyroidism and recovering from diets, it appears that I was onto something all along. Number one, if you are in a metabolically compromised state, bedtime snacks are not only okay, but beneficial. And if you've been living your life from diet to diet and are reading this post, you are most likely in a metabolically compromised state. The most important way to support yourself through adrenal fatigue or a slow system or hypothyroidism is to eat. And that includes before bed. And it can and should include carbs and fat too. Wait, I'm going to take a little pause and say that I have been continually floored and amazed by my old posts that I fear are going to be bad. I was also way more into reading the science behind everything I was doing back then because I needed to prove to myself that I wasn't insane. I don't do that anymore because I know that I'm not insane and I know that it works. And I kind of did all that research in the past and just I'm letting it sit. But I understand that people who are new to it do want to hear the science. So that's another reason that I'm reading these through. And I'm continually amazed that I actually had the information that I did back then. Okay, number two, calories don't need to constantly be burned off. One of the reasons people have argued against eating at bedtime is that your body will turn the food to fat because it can't burn it off. But this is submitting to that incorrect, stressful, and disordered assumption that calories need to be manically burned off as soon as they're consumed. This is just false and a huge reason why obsessive cardio doesn't work as well. Don't get on the treadmill of calories burned obsession. Okay, that's a terrible sentence. But basically, that is a disordered way of looking at how your body uses fuel. Number three, true starvation at bedtime can point you in the right direction. Meaning, even though there is no problem eating a substantial snack at bedtime, and it can help people whose metabolisms are out of whack or recovering to sleep better, if you are insatiably hungry at bedtime, chances are you did not eat enough during the day. Ding, 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 ding. If you don't eat enough during the day, your body is going to be hungry to get those calories one way or another. I don't know what that sentence is. Logical. This is logical. Your hunger at bedtime is your body trying to make sure you get enough calories during the day before it goes to sleep and has to do lots of detoxing and repairing. One mistake I would make in my earlier intuitive eating, in quotes, days, was to get in a habit of listening to my body during the day, and I put that in quotes too, and not eating very much because I was listening so closely that I was under eating all the time. But then by the time bedtime rolled around, I had to eat a huge midnight meal because I had not eaten enough during the day, which is fine. But it is sort of it's inconvenient and also showing you kind of where you're off balance. So if you find yourself extremely hungry at bedtime, let this be your full permission to eat more during the day. You clearly need it anyway. So in conclusion, let yourself eat those midnight snacks. They don't need to be done sneakily or guiltily, and they don't need to be done standing in the fridge, just like the name of that one Janine Roth book, when you eat at the fridge, when you eat at the refrigerator, pull up a chair. Oh, Caroline. Okay. That's not about midnight snacks per se, but about giving your permission, again, I have a lot of typos in here, but about giving yourself permission to eat for goodness' sake. Ugh. Okay. I might pause this and actually edit this before I move on to the next thing. Anyway, this is how I ended the post. Anyway, don't listen to dumb diet rules. Fuck it. Yeah. I hope that was clear, but basically, like, if you're really hungry at night, you should eat, and also it's normally a sign that you didn't eat enough. Oh, God, kombucha. You didn't eat enough during the day. I'm pausing this. I'm going to edit this post and come back to you with the next post. Bye. Okay, my next door neighbors in the row home next to me are watching some kind of television, so if you hear that, that's what it is. I just edited that post, and I essentially took out a lot of stuff because I find that I overwrite, meaning I write more than I need to. I go on and on in a way that I don't need to. Okay, I'm moving on to the next post. The next post is from June 26, 2012. Cravings don't need to be fought, which is sugar part two, in defense of sugar part two. How many times have you heard about combating sugar cravings or reducing carb cravings? I've heard vegans supporting each other on overcoming meat cravings, and hell, when I was raw vegan, I would read in the community forums people discussing overcoming their evil and addictive cooked food cravings. Cooked food cravings, oh, the horrors. In my post in defense of sugar part one, I talked about how I came to believe that sugar was not inherently bad. Here, I will go more in depth and relate it to addiction cravings and more of the mental components. The sugar addiction myth. Sugar is treated like an evil drug, and any desire for it is feared and shamed. And while it is true that sugar can be used like a drug in binges or eating to numb, it is not inherently evil or bad, and neither is the desire or craving for it. Craving carbs is not a symptom to be squelched. Craving carbs is not a symptom to be squelched. I am under the firm belief that food cravings are not a problem unless you have denial or guilt associated with the craving. In my opinion and experience, denial and guilt are the things that lead to the binging and intensified and irrational food cravings, not the food itself. If there was no, I'm having like a really hard time breathing. I need to turn this off and clear my throat. I'm back. Okay. If there was no guilt attached to a craving, you would eat it and go on with your day. You would digest it and gain the maximum benefit from your food that your body had been asking for, cookies included, and you'd probably be feeling great. Last Supper Syndrome, the next section. Wow, I'm really speaking weirdly. Last Supper Syndrome. If you are giving into a craving under the conditions of just this once and never again, then you will most likely subconsciously fear for your impending lack and potentially abuse it. Maybe overeating until you're sick. I wish that I could rewrite all this and I might do it again just like that. But you know what I'm saying. And then you blame the problem on the food itself instead of your disordered relationship with food. You will also have feelings of guilt associated with eating this food. And guilt has never helped. No, no, nobody. But you swear you really are addicted to sugar. This is what I have come to see. This is what I have come to see that the supposed sugar addiction really is. Eating carbs and sugar is calming and feel good for the brain. Wow, I really wrote, I was just writing to write. There was no editing ever happening. Eating carbs and sugar is calming and feel good for the brain. And I said feel good like, you know what I mean, like a feel good movie. But I should have just said feels good. This is normal and natural. If you do not allow yourself to eat carbs regularly, you may find yourself quote unquote addicted to the way you feel on carbs when you give in to your natural cravings for them. This may lead to overeating or binging. Is this because carbs are bad? No, it's because you're denying them. Sugar also elevates blood sugar. This is also normal and natural. If you're not used to eating sugar, your body will not handle the sugar well. It may rise too high, it may rise and crash, leaving you to crave more. Is this because carbs are bad? No, it's because you're denying them and not used to metabolizing them. The more you deny carbs, the more you risk addiction symptoms because the feel-good properties, the body's ability to metabolize them, and because of abuse due to denial and guilt mentally. What does this mean? Start eating what you crave. I do not know what you crave. I would never dream of forcing you to eat cookies or pizza or a rotisserie chicken just because that is what I craved and ate today. You are the only one who knows what you crave. Your cravings may not be rational, but do not discredit them. What you crave is what you need, especially if you're in the beginning of this recovery process. I added that, obviously. I was thinking of the words and not reading them. Not only because your body is probably asking for something quite specific, but also because the longer you deny your cravings, the more insane and intense they may become. Well, what if you crave Twinkies? Should you trust yourself then? Do I think that there is great nutritional value in Twinkies? Not necessarily. The reason you crave them specifically and not cake is probably psychological, linked to some past denial or memory from childhood. But it is a food, and if you crave it, the sooner you start eating as many damn Twinkies as you want, the sooner the Twinkies will likely loosen their hold over you. The first healing that has to happen is your denial and guilt relationship with food. Only then can you feed your body for the right reasons instead of fear-based reasons, denial reasons, or guilt reasons. So, should you be eating lots and lots of carbs? I wonder what I said here. While I do not believe that sugar or carbs are villains and that they are not... Oh, wait. While I do not believe that sugar or carbs are villains and that they are necessary, for example, for optimum thyroid function, etc., that does not mean that I believe people always need to be pounding sodas and cakes for their health and well-being, obviously. Again, it all comes down to what you crave. That is something that will morph and change as you go on this journey. But I feel very strongly about defending and supporting carbs because one, your body needs carbs. Two, denial of cravings often leads to disordered eating. Three, guilt with cravings. Guilt because of cravings often leads to disordered eating. And four, food phobias are detrimental to intuitive eating. I think that a moderate, healthy intake of carbs is only sustainable and health supporting if it is coming from your true desires and cravings. Only then will you eat what nourishes you and be happy to stop when you are satisfied. Not out of fear for your waistline and health, but out of a true desire to nourish yourself with those foods. But the only way to get to that point is to allow yourself to heal your relationship with food, which means allowing and indulging all of your cravings, which may lead you to eat a shit ton of sugar for a while. And I want you to be okay with that. Great. I should be editing that post, but I'm not going to. We're going to move right along to June 30th, 2012, in defense of dairy. I've heard it all the reasons dairy is apparently horrible for you. Not only is it labeled pus, thank you, skinny bitch book, but it is filled with hormones. It spikes insulin, casein, I think that's how it's pronounced, is addictive. Everyone is lactose intolerant. It's a Neolithic food. We're adults and don't need milk. And even the most mainstream and fatphobic reason, it's loaded with saturated fat. Lots of groups like to give you their reasons why milk and dairy are health wreckers, but I'm here to argue in milk's defense. Note, if you can't already tell, science is not my main currency. If you want people who actually research science and try to explain it to you, I recommend also reading more of Matt Stone and Danny Roddy. but I deal in experience and feelings. I let other people's research inform my feelings and decisions, but my main goal is to bust your food phobias. Science helps me do that, so I will try to link to the evidence that may enlighten your scientific minds better than I can. That's the end of that section. I thought it was going to go on. Also, it just is worth saying that back then in the beginning of the Feca diet, I was sort of into reading Ray Peet. He's a doctor who talks about food. I was into reading Ray Peet, and he definitely has some fear-mongering about other foods, but he really believes that thyroid function is so important for health, and that not eating enough sugar and carbs will hurt your thyroid function. And he also is a big believer in health, in like a natural milk. Obviously, you know, milk pumped with hormones and all that stuff is not, you know, the best for the world or probably your body, but it still is better than not eating food. Okay. Sorry, I have this cold. I keep thinking that... Oh. Hold on. I have to turn this off again. Okay, I'm back. I'm moving my microphone further away because I think it's broken. Okay, lactose intolerance. Many people are lactose intolerant, or in quotes, lactose intolerant. I was diagnosed as lactose intolerant at 2 years old. 2 years old and grew up drinking rice milk and eating soy cheese. I really wrote drinking rice milk and soy cheese. I didn't drink soy cheese. But I would sneak real cheese at school. In fact, my shtick in the cafeteria was that I would go to the salad bar and fill up a whole bowl of shredded cheese and eat it with my hands. Delicious. I was a fuck it dieter long before I was a dieter, that's for sure. But I found I could actually tolerate cheese no problem, and also that it was my favorite food. But milk, which I rarely tried and never really liked anyway, made me feel bloated. Lots of the extreme diets I went on argued against dairy, and because of my lactose intolerance, I believed them even more. But it's not the milk's fault. I read recently that lactose intolerance is not the milk's fault. It is our fault. They argue that the difficulty digesting it is due to impaired gut function and low thyroid function, and that in many cases, slowly adding it back in can help our bodies adjust to digesting it. Not only did Ray Peet, there's his name, and Danny Roddy convince me to give milk another go, but also the Weston A. Price Foundation's support of raw dairy consumption. Not only that, but the restrictive GAPS diet that I tried and failed, that actually led me straight to the Feca diet, even supports daily dairy consumption as well. So blah, blah, blah. Real food enthusiasts insist that milk should be raw. Ray Peet seems to think that even pasteurized milk can be beneficial. Oh, good. So I began drinking some. First, a glass of pasteurized milk, which did leave me bloated. But I was at my parents' home in PA at the time where... What? Oh, at the time? Oh, yeah, okay. But I was also at my parents' home in PA at the time where... I'm having a really hard time. Anyway, raw milk is easier to get in PA than in New York. So the next day I had some raw milk and I felt fine! Exclamation point! I kept drinking raw milk for a few days. When I ran out, I decided to have another glass of pasteurized milk. This is such a boring story and I felt fine. I'm going to remove this part from the post. I felt fine. I cured a lifelong case of lactose intolerance. Then I started on the ice cream. While I would say that raw milk is probably best, I think it is amazing that it alone cured my inability to drink pasteurized milk. I'm now back living in New York where raw milk is far more difficult to get, so I drink pasteurized grass-fed milk sometimes, and I eat ice cream a lot. Guys, ice cream is such a big part of my fuck it diet. I like never eat ice cream these days, but I ate it every day. I eat so much Haagen-Dazs, which is why my pen name, before I actually listed myself as Caroline Dooner, it was Caroline Haagen for Haagen-Dazs. Okay, so is milk a beneficial and or essential part of the diet? I don't know, and I don't even think I care. I'm in the business of busting food myths and food phobias. I wanted to show myself that I could and give myself the option to drink milk and eat ice cream if that's what I crave. I already tolerated cream in my coffee and all the cheese. I wanted the freedom and the option to go even further. Plus, I had a feeling that it could be great. This is just such a stupid post. I'm trying to tell you, dear reader, that if you're scared of milk, there is no need. And if you are lactose intolerant or even allergic to milk, it's probably not the milk. It may just be your body's state. And if it is worth it to you to acclimate to drinking milk, you probably can. How are we supposed to eat what we crave when we're afraid of food that might be good for us or whatever? Milk's benefits in simple terms. Milk is loaded with protein, vitamin D, vitamin A, vitamin K2, and B2 and B12 vitamins, as well as grass-fed milk having conjugated linoleic acid, CLA, and amazing for you fat. These are all vitamins that are not quite abundant in other foods and definitely not abundant in plant foods. Milk is easy to consume and the nutrients are easy to absorb. I think the best thing about milk and cheese and ice cream, though, is that it's one of the highest foods in saturated fat, which is a good thing. Hello. It supports healthy cell, hormone, and brain function, as well as being anti-inflammatory. Do you hear that? These are all of the kinds of research and reading that I would do back in the old days. I don't do this research anymore. Remember, my goal is to take away unnecessary food phobias to allow your cravings to be king. Don't listen to those ladies who wrote Skinny Bitch. Just because they have a book doesn't make them right. And just because I have a blog doesn't make me right. Listen to yourself and fuck it. All right, we're moving on to the next post. But first, I'm going to check my Facebook notifications. Okay. July 2nd, 2012. So, what about emotional eating? I don't know if I'm going to agree with what I said about emotional eating way back when. Oh, I'm sorry, guys. Okay. If you've read enough of my posts already, you know I don't believe in diets. I don't believe in letting food choices stress you out, and I think cravings are not demons within... What? Oh. And cravings are not demons within that we need to destroy. What a horrible sentence. But instead, are wonderful little messages that can lead us to delicious food choices and good, intuitive, holistic health. I need to edit that. I also don't believe that it's helpful to hold ourselves to impossibly high health standards. Whoa, I linked to so many things in this. I argue in defense of sugar, fat, dairy, midnight snacks, and more to come in order to help people stop fearing food and start eating it. Stop restricting and start nourishing. But there's a little thing called emotional eating. I really wonder what I'm going to say. I'm very curious. And while I argue that the majority of disordered eating is rooted in denial, and disconnection from cravings, which is all physical reaction stuff, sometimes people just eat to stop feeling, or to numb is what I call it now. And here we get into the emotional and spiritual side of eating. As Jeanine Roth says in Women, Food, and God, how we eat is how we live, and how we think of food is how we think of God, in quotes. Please, please, please substitute a word if you're like to your liking if the word God irks you. It can irk me. And I will use the word life in its place sometimes. The way we eat can reveal to us what we believe about life. Are we afraid there's not enough? Are we constantly afraid to eat too much? Constantly restricting? Constantly guilty? Constantly hungry? How to address emotional eating. I don't know what I'm gonna say. If you find yourself eating in response to sad or stressful situations instead of pure hunger, as many people do, you are afraid of your pain. Oh, whoa. I'm so glad I said this. We are afraid that the anger we have. We are afraid that the anger we have will consume us. We are afraid that the fear we have will destroy us. We are afraid that the sadness we squelch will debilitate us. And yes, it is scary, but we are wrong. It cannot destroy us. Pain is just pain. Our avoidance and resistance to the pain is far worse than actually just feeling it. And the solution is simple, transformative, and not nearly as difficult as it seems. Feel. Whatever you accept fully will complete itself and disappear, which is from a funny, weird little book that I once read that has stuck with me called Working on Yourself Doesn't Work which I partially agree with. You can still always eat after or during the feeling. In fact, I encourage you to eat always, but not before you feel. Sometimes I tell people that's not true. You just have to make a contract with yourself to start letting yourself feel the things you're afraid to feel. Simply feel the sensation of your pain. Label it, accept it, welcome it, and be curious about it. And when you feel it, accept it, and welcome it non-judgmentally, it really does lose its power. It just becomes a thing, not a horror. Then you can go and eat whatever you want, not because you're avoiding your life and your feelings, but because you're damn hungry, or even not. Whoa, that's the end of that. All right, I'm going to edit this, and I'll be right back, folks. I'm back. All right, intuitive eating myth. Wait, this I did July 6, 2012. Intuitive eating myth, the perfect stopping point. The idea of intuitive eating is to listen to your internal cues rather than external cues to guide what and how much you eat. The hope is that you will listen to your cravings and hunger to determine when to stop eating. As I said in my previous post, I believe the only way to easily and naturally stop when you're satisfied, as opposed to nervously eating more than is comfortable, is to truly allow all foods and commit to never restricting again. Don't stress out over new rules. One of the rules or guidelines that you will often hear about intuitive eating is to stop when you are full. While I agree that this is a tenet of intuitive eating, I wrote tenet, like David Tennant, a tenet of intuitive eating, sometimes coming from that angle can be stressful. I recall on past intuitive eating attempts getting truly stressed out when I was full. I was very concerned that I was going to overshoot and not learn how to do it correctly and gain weight. I have heard from other intuitive eating teachers and books things like, pay close attention to your hunger. Rate your hunger every few bites. Pay attention. Satisfaction can happen mid-bite. Well, I think it's sure helpful to pay attention to how you feel during your eating. The way that was phrased really stressed me the fuck out. It made me believe that there was one perfect stopping point that I should always be finding when I was eating. And there is not. There are many bites on a scale of good stopping points. And any point or any bite on that scale is perfectly fine. Your body can handle a few extra bites or even more than that. You may be slightly fuller, but as long as you are listening and feeling and enjoying, you're doing well. And your body makes up for it in slightly longer satiation or a faster metabolism that afternoon or slightly less hunger for your next meal or snack. Blah, whatever. There is no virtue in stopping just at the perfect point. Just at the perfect point, or just before you get full, which is another thing I used to try to do. There is no problem being that in tune or even stopping before you're full if you have things to do or whatever. But expecting there to be a perfect point every time you eat, a perfect stopping point, it's just going to leave you frustrated, especially in the beginning of your intuitive eating journey. There is no perfect point. Trying to find it will just stress you out. And just for the hell of it, in defense of overeating. Not binging, there's a distinction. Binging is manic and unpleasant. Overeating is just overeating. Or even just, I should just have called this eating a lot. Or no, overeating implies that you have eaten past your hunger and you're now very full. Beep boop, beep boop. And then I said, though, if you happen to binge too, following these truths may also calm you down. Overeating, or eating more than you actually wanted in retrospect, teaches your body there is no famine. It teaches your mind that there is no restriction. It activates your metabolism. It teaches you how it feels to stop at different points of fullness. It proves to you that eating past fullness cannot destroy you. It focuses on nourishing instead of restricting. Do not get caught up in intuitive eating perfectionism. It will not help you. All right, I'm pausing to edit this post too. A couple weeks later, I realize I've been pausing for a couple weeks. I am sitting here weeks after I read all of those posts, wanting to publish this and also wanting to tell my lovely and loyal listeners that I'm just going to take a couple weeks more hiatus. I just bought this house. I am opening this show that I'm in Philadelphia tonight. I will be moving. There will be holidays. I'm running Fucketeer Academy and I'm writing my book. The wonderful woman that I am. Also, you might be able to hear the, washing machine in the background. Sorry about that. The woman that I'm writing the Fuck It Diet book with just sent me a big chunk of it and we're reading through and we're talking about it. Actually, that makes it sound like she's a ghostwriter and I've been sending her essays. We've been talking about how we're going to organize them, etc., etc., etc. Anyway, I'm just going to take a month and a half hiatus from this podcast. Not that I haven't already been doing that, but I'm just going to intentionally do it and let you guys know that I will be podcasting again at the end of January and that I hope you guys have a wonderful, wonderful, beautiful holiday season. And that I hope to come back to you nice and refreshed. Hey, you know, I don't keep my promises, meaning sometimes I say I'm going to do something and I don't do it. Sometimes I say I'm not going to do something and then I do it. So it's possible that I'll be doing little blurb podcasts here and there to say hello and to sing Joni Mitchell's River or whatever, you know. But until then, I say this is going to be a little pause and I will talk to you at the end of January. Arrivederci.